Well, good morning and happy St. Patrick's Day. Yay! The day where everybody's a little Irish except for us Scots. We're still Scottish. So anyway, so glad to be with you this morning. I was laughing also, kind of the worship team. You had three of them that were celebrating the day. And then we had Dr. Joe over here. So I'm going to rename the band Dr. Joe and the St. Patties because they were rocking it, man. It was perfect, man. It was just set up exactly the way it should be. So, hey, we are in our last Sunday in this Sunday school series. We did this back in the fall, and we did a little one here for now. We're looking at messy heroes, and today is one of my favorite messy heroes. In fact, of all the stories in the Bible, this lands as one of the favorites. It's also one of the least messy of the messy characters. Still a little bit of messiness in their lives. And so, if you go to the very center of your Bible, you're going to hit the book of Psalms. And if you take a slight left, you're going to hit Job. And then if you go a little further to the left, you're going to hit this favorite story, the story of Esther. That is the story we're looking at today. And here's a few reasons why I love Esther. First of all, I love her because it's an underdog story. Like, here's this woman, does not choose her fate, does not want the circumstance she's in, but accepts the circumstance with all of its mess, all of its ugly, all of its heartbreak. She just accepts that, leans into it, and is there for such a time that she needed to be there. The other reason I love this as a hero story is because it is a female who's the hero. In a world that is dominated by men, in a world where females would never normally be even given room to be considered a hero, she steps up to be the ultimate hero. She saves an entire people group, an entire race of individuals are rescued because of the work that she does. And so I love all of that. The other reason, though, I love this story is because it's actually an interactive story. We've done this before. So like years and years ago, before we owned property, had a hub, any of that kind of stuff, we did this story. And what's great about it is in the Jewish tradition, when they read this, they do it every year, roughly around this time of year, and it's called Purim. And Purim is this remembrance of this time when the people of God were almost exterminated, and then they literally just read the story out loud, and as they read it to a synagogue or to a family or whatever else, as certain names come up, people respond when the name comes up. So Esther is, of course, the chief hero. She doesn't get any, like, wordplay, but when the character of Mordecai comes up, everybody cheers. Yeah, so when I'm reading the text today and Mordecai comes up, you go, yay, Mordecai, right? He's a stud. But then there's this other dude and his name is Haman. You remember, some of you, this is perfect. So when Haman comes up, you must boo. Mordecai is a? Yay. Boom. Haman is a? Yeah, sorry. Now, you're going to be doing that a lot today, all right? So I took notes mostly out of your hands so you can be ready, poised, engaged to do it. And every time it's in the text, I'll say these names in my little commentary. If we do it every time there, we'll all be exhausted by the end. But you know, good. So when I'm reading the text and you see those names, cheer or boo, that's perfect. Now, in the Jewish tradition of this story, they also make it a drinking game. Legit. So every time Mordecai, yay, pop. And then Haman, boo, but still take a drink. And the idea is by the end, you can't discern the names. And we're not going to do that here. So we're going sober, but we're still going to give a lot of gusto to this whole thing. So that is our mission for the day. So let's go ahead and pray together. And we're going to jump right into the story. Jesus, I thank you that there are these stories of unexpected heroes who are doing right things in wrong, awful contexts and figuring out the best way to do it with the wisdom they have, the circumstances and conditions they're in. And I pray that that teaches us because we all live in a messy world just like Esther did. Help us to be what you want us to be and to figure out how we bring your heart and voice to bear on the world that we might find ourselves in, just as these people did as well. And so we look to you to teach us and guide us today and just remind us of what it is we're here to do. We love you, Jesus. We thank you and we praise you in your good name. Amen. All right, so our story begins in chapter 1, verse 1 of the book of Esther, and it is in the days of Ahasuerus, or you might know him as Xerxes. This is the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. Now, typically, when we open up with a story like that, we tend to look and go, okay, so names I can barely pronounce in places I don't know, in a period that I'm unfamiliar with. And so I want to take a minute to kind of anchor where this story falls in the bigger story that we have been kind of touching on for months in these Sunday school stories. So for example, last week we looked at Samson, and he's alive during the time of the judges. And so you have Moses, they come out of Egypt, Joshua takes over the people group from there, the Israelites settle into the land, and then they start to have this downtrend through the season of the judges, and it gets to Samson, and he's a mess, like all the other judges were a mess. And from that, we see this new thing kick in, which is the reign of the kings. And the first three kings of Israel are going to be Saul, and he has his issues. Then David, we all know David. Then Solomon, and Solomon has his issues. But then after that, the people of Israel, they divide into two groups. 10 tribes go to the north, 2 tribes go to the south. The northern tribes consistently, every time, have kings that are unfaithful, ungodly, follow the other gods. And so eventually God says, you're under judgment. The Assyrians come in, wipe out, and just pull away from the land those 10 tribes, never to really return again in the way that they were understood. The southern two tribes, they hold on for a while, but eventually then the Babylonians come in under Nebuchadnezzar, and they take the last two remaining tribes into Babylonian captivity. Now, what's cool about what the Jews do during that time is they don't hate their oppressors, they don't resist their captors, they don't have some underground revolution trying to figure out how to overthrow, like, the Babylonians. They kind of just settle in, because the prophet Jeremiah says, you know what, when you go there, just bless the city that you're in. Do good things, fight for its welfare, because in their welfare is your welfare. So they just make investment. They just engage into the empire that is. This is why you have guys like Daniel working so hard to help the Babylonians thrive. That was just their heart. But we know that the Babylonians, eventually, they can't kind of keep up their power structure. And so it's the Persians, or the Medo-Persian Empire, that then comes in and kind of takes away the power of Babylon. This is Darius that is the real kind of focal point of that incursion, taking over the Babylonians, sending up the Persians. And so then he's doing business for a while, and he's trying to concentrate and consolidate power to himself. And so the empire during that time grows to about 50 million people. It is huge by every sense of what you can understand. And then he keeps pressing further. So he goes into Greece. But when he goes to Greece, he gets punked, man. Absolutely punked. So if you know of the Battle of Marathon, where an Athenian runner runs and gets the Spartans, and the Spartans come back and kind of take on the Persians, that whole thing where we get the word marathon from, that happens. And so Darius gets his butt kicked, basically, becomes angry, vengeful, bitter, but then he dies. And he leaves the throne to his son, and his son's name is Ahasuerus, or in Greek, Xerxes. And if you've ever seen the movie 300, you know the bald, bronze, buff, Mr. Clean-looking dude in that movie? That's Xerxes. That's Ahasuerus. And so he takes up his dad's mantle. He's going to go to war. He's going to do stuff in the way that he wants to. So he goes and he tries to fight the Greeks again and against the Spartans beat him. And then he goes and sends a naval fleet, and they get wiped out. All this stuff happens. And so based on that, what you see at the start of the book of Esther is he's pulling together all of his leaders and military officials to have this 6-month confab to go, like, how do we go forward? Because we just got our butt handed to us. We keep losing battles. We need to figure out what the next move is. And so that's chapter 1 of the book of Esther. That's how it fits into the history timeline. What you also have to understand, though, about how they did things back then is while this is sort of this executive meeting of all the brain trust to come together to solve the problems, it's also a little bit like a trip to Vegas for all the executives. Like, it's this weird environment that for those 6 months, man, they're thinking about stuff, they're trying to solve problems, but at the end, they're going to have a big, crazy, wild, insane party. It is a complete, like, full frat boy kegger sex fest. That's exactly the way it goes down. Because you got to remember, these are pagan people. They're all about living it up. And if you're rich and powerful and you have fame, you live it up recklessly and wildly. In fact, so much so, in chapter 1, verse 8, it says, drinking at this 7-day finale was according to this edict, there is no compulsion, right? For the king had given orders to the staff of his palace, to each man, whatever he wants to do, let him do it. That is reckless. It's crazy, it's dangerous, it's wild. It's like, just imagine if like Charlie Sheen and Pete Davidson and I don't know, like Miley Cyrus got together with a multi-million dollar budget and said, let's have a party. Like that's kind of what this environment is. And so everybody's drinking, they're getting wasted, and drinking leads to dumb. And sometimes the worst kind of drinking dumb is the dumb where you think you're smart, right? Like you're so wasted, every idea is like, that's a great idea, man, do that thing. So that's exactly what happens. And on the last day of the party, the king's like, I got an idea. I'm gonna have my queen wife come out either scantily clad or no clothing at all, except the crown on her head. And she's gonna dance before all of my officials. It's gonna be a great time. I'm sure it's gonna go great when you ask your wife to do such a thing in front of all your frat buddies, right? I'm sure that's gonna be great. Well, his wife basically says, honey, pound sand. I'm not gonna do that, right? It's not gonna happen. And so it says, at this, the king was enraged and burned with anger at her. And you have to understand, as he does this, he is not the model of mental stability at all. At all. Like some of these movies they make about Esther and the king, it's like he's just this tortured Persian king that has high ideals but can't live those out, but he loves this girl and they make some kind of nice. That's not this dude. That is an absolute fabrication of who Xerxes is. He is a guy that is crazy, crazy nuts and easily angered. In fact, in one of their campaigns into Greece, he wanted to build a bridge so he could move troops across. And in the construction of the bridge, there were some high seas where it was crossing the waterway. The bridge collapses, and he's so mad, he kills the 300 engineers who were building the bridge just because, hey, like it's somehow their fault. And then he orders all of his soldiers out into the water with whips to whip the water. Like when you stub your toe and you hit your fist on the table, like the table somehow knows you're hitting it. That's kind of what he's doing with the sea. He's just that kind of illogical guy that's just angry and bitter and just gets easily mad. So that's kind of what she's dealing with. And so she says no, and he's angry. And the king's like, listen, I've been insulted and disobeyed in front of my peers, in front of my military officers. What are they gonna think of me based on this? And so he convenes his legal officials, and he's like, what should we do, guys? Because she's done this thing. And they go, oh, dude, you got a bigger problem. It says, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and peoples who are in the province of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, well, because the king commanded the queen and she did whatever she wanted, we're all going to be in trouble. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media will have heard of the queen's behavior, and they will say the same thing of the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. So basically, all that's going on is, king, we're men. We wear the pants. And they're going to start telling us which pair to wear. We don't want to be told which pair to wear. We wear our pair, not them. We got to deal with these women. That's the problem. So they're all worked up. What I love about the queen here, she's kicked off the first women's suffrage movement. You know, she's like, all right, we're gonna stand up. We're gonna fight for our rights. Thus, the men's club comes together and makes a law. It says, if it pleases the king, let a royal order go out from him and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and Medes so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her a royal position or give her royal position to another who is better than she. So it's like, oh, misogyny, is there no problem you can't fix? Just kick her out, cancel her, be done with her, find somebody else. So that's kind of the plan. Crisis averted. But then in time, the king's like, I remember that whole thing. And his anger recedes, and he's starting to ponder. It says, after these things, when the anger of the king had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. So then the king's young men who attended him said, let a beautiful young virgin, a bunch of them, in fact, be sought out for the king. So this sounds exactly what a bunch of young guys would do, right? Like, king, I know you're lonely. I know you're sad. I got a great idea. Let's go find babes. get a lot of babes, bro. That's a good idea. That's a good idea. Yeah, let's get some babes, right? So it's like that. Dude, yeah, good idea. So that's their plan, right? So they said, let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of the kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young women who pleases the king, one particular that kind of can rise to the top, let her become queen instead of Vashti. And this pleased the king. And so he said, let's go do that. But you go, of course it pleases the king. He's an old crotchety pervert with a temperament. He's like, sweet, I get the ultimate episode of The Bachelor, right? Which is all that is, putting a bunch of women in a house for one dude. Let's call it what it is, right? That's what's going on, right? He's like, this is fantastic. They're all gonna serve my interests. They're all gonna compete for my affection, which isn't really affection, it's a lust. But that's what they're going to do. Now here, in just getting into the real honesty of the story, because we kind of read these things and go, oh yeah, that's what happened. But this is tragic in a lot of ways, right? An empire of 50 million people means hundreds or thousands of girls are gonna be taken from their families, taken from their place of residence, taken from the land that they know, and they're gonna be forced into an environment where basically they're sex trafficked. They're tested out by the king. And the king's gonna decide which of these one he really wants, and the rest are just gonna be kind of put into this place of forever being at his beck and call, but without any kind of power or freedom or leverage or whatever. So it's, in a lot of ways, you just gotta see this as it is. It's just a super terrible environment that now our friend Esther's gonna be a part of. She's gonna be thrust into a world that is exploitive toward her. And so the king is, I guess, setting up his Tinder profile or something, I don't know. Rich, crazy, angry, heavy drinking king looking for a nice, sweet girl who likes to wear crowns when they're told, like whatever it is. So the scene unfolds and we see the center of the story begin to come together. It says, now there is a Jew in Susa the citadel whose name was Mordecai. Yay! He's a Benjaminite, right? And he was carried away from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar back in the day. So he's been a part of this process. And he was bringing up Hadassah, which is her Hebrew name. Her Greek name is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. And then it describes her. This young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his daughter. So Mordecai's a good guy, and he's looking out for her. Now, when you read that description, it's interesting because it doesn't say, and then there was Esther, smart, strong, wise, bold, brilliant. No, what's it say? She's hot. That's all she gets. Like, in the world that she lives in, that's how she's measured. She's objectified. She's got a nice body, cute face, she qualifies. Which, in a lot of ways, that just kind of highlights this thing that she's dealing with. Now, they don't realize that inside this woman is fortitude and insight and grit and just resolve. All of which will be vital in what she's called to do. That's in her. It's just not being looked for in her. Like, people don't notice that in her world. So it says, when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa the citadel in the custody of Haggai, Esther was also taken into the king's palace and put in custody of this eunuch who had charge of the women. And so this sweet Hebrew girl is now the sexual property of the Persian Empire. And she has no real control. Now, in a very real sense, you know what she could do? She could say, you know what, I'm not going along with this. You can't make me do it. My chastity is more important. I don't care if I die. I'm not gonna give into this. She could do that, but she doesn't do that. She seems to say, you know what, this is my lot. This is where I'm at. I'm gonna leverage my tools with what I have to get something done. I don't know what that is, how it's gonna be, how it's gonna come about, but she is going to stay in the pocket of a very hard thing. And so she has this pragmatic response to this conditional problem, working with what she has and waiting on God for whatever comes next. It says, well, this young woman pleased this eunuch of the king and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with cosmetics and a portion of food, and he gave her 7 chosen young women from the king's palace and advanced her and her young woman to the best place in the harem. which is not exactly something you write home about. Yay, most objectified woman in the whole place. But see, this eunuch is beginning to see something in her that, again, everybody else doesn't see yet. Because he's not obstructed by his biology, right? As a eunuch, he's not going to feel those lustful feelings, those sexual feelings for her, so he can see past those things to something more profound, more deep. And he's like, there's something about this girl that's different. At the same time, he knows why she's here, and he knows the appetite of the king. And so he is going to coach her and train her and equip her and favor her to really enter into the queen's spot. Like, that's what he's going to do. And yet all of this will serve a much bigger purpose. And the bigger purpose gets hinted at after it says that in verse 9. It then says in verse 10 that Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. So even Mordecai is like, listen, we're not always well-liked as a people. And so you don't want to reveal who you're connected to, because then you may not even move up in the spot, right? So just you stay quiet, we stay quiet. We're playing the long game, not the short game, but we're going to play this long game as long and as well as we can. And play is exactly what it is. Truly, she has to play along in this whole scenario. It says when it came time for Esther to go into the king, she asked for nothing except with what Haggai, the king's eunuch, had advised. And when Esther was taken into King Ahasuerus, into his royal palace, the king loved Esther more than all the women. And she won grace and favor in his sight, more than all the other virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Now again, this is no Hallmark movie. This is no A Night with the King. That's really not how this plays. Again, like I said, this is a sad reality of countless women who are tested out sexually by this man until she finally wins the top spot. She doesn't want to have to go along with this, but she's just going along with this because this is just what's expected. This is the world that she lives in. She has to serve the interests and indulgences of this man. She needed to be the best in the bunch in every sexual way. That's the only way she's getting to the top. And it's measured in hundreds or thousands of women. It's incredible to think. But in this sense, God's girl isn't necessarily true love waits or promise rings or purity culture, right? She's not going to suffer and die at the hands of fighting for her chastity. No, she just realizes, you know, this is my station. This is what I'm going to need to do at this time and in this way. She embraces the mess and she leans into the tools. And then from it says, well, the king loved her more than all the other virgins. Which isn't like deep affection. That's not the word that's used here. It's more like he was like, hey, she's pretty good to look at. She's fun to hang out with overnight. She would make a great queen. Of all of the women, she would be the best. So it's not that they sat around all night and he's like, hey, what do you think about geopolitical things, Miss America? Here's your question. It wasn't that. It was just like, hey, she's good enough to be on my right arm. Perfect. I'm going to take her. She's fit for me. So in that sense, she was the kind of the brightest flame in a burning hot embers. It's like, you know, they're all attractive, but she's the one. And so we have this attractive, intelligent, shrewd Jewish girl married to an angry, feisty dude with a God complex, by the way, because Xerxes thought he actually was divine, but she's keeping her ethnicity secret for the time being. And so the king bachelor gives the rose, right? Says, you're going to be the one, and everybody else gets a tax break during this time, which is great, right? So she gets chosen, everybody else gets to keep some of their money. Well, at the same time, there's another part of the story happening. So all of that's going on, bachelor, Persian styles happening. And then over here, down at the king's gate, is our man Mordecai. And he hears of a plot to assassinate the king. And so he goes to Esther, he's like, listen, you got to tell the king, these guys are going to try to wax him. And so she goes and tells him, they investigate it, they find out the assassination is going to be true, and they execute those guys. And then from that, they're like, well, man, we got to record for our records that Mordecai did this thing and he saved the king. And so that's exactly what happens. It's recorded, and you got to remember it's recorded because that's going to be a thing that comes up later. And so where the story then sits is we have Mordecai the Benjaminite. You can still cheer, that's awesome. He's a Benjaminite. And then you've got Esther, and she's also a Benjaminite, and they're both kind of attached to the king. And in this, Mordecai has been a good guy that has done some saving graces toward this king. So why is all of this important? Well, it says, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Yeah. Haman the Agagite, if you can get that spit out. Agagite. Now, that might not mean anything to you as well. You might be like, well, who cares what he is? Okay, backstory again. Who is the first king of Israel? Saul. Saul was a Benjaminite. What was he called to do? Deal with the Amalekites. Who is in charge of the Amalekites that he goes to deal with? Agag. All right, so this is a family squabble, 500 years old. That's a long carried grudge, man. Right? So when it says Haman, the Agagite, I can't even get it out still. That dude is like, man, your great, 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 great grampy tried to kill and effectively in the end still ended up dying. My great, 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 great. So we hate each other. And so there is bitter water between them, right? And so what we see is the king's like, well, hey, I got this guy. And he advanced him and he set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all of the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman. Boo. For the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow or pay homage. Bro, not going to do it. Now, part of the reason he doesn't do it is because he's like, hey, this is sort of worshipful. Like, I only bow my knee to the one true God. I'm not going to bow my knee to this dude like he's a god. I'm not going to bow my knee to anybody like they're a god. I only worship my God. So he's not just being a punk and trying to be difficult. He's like, no, this is wrong. I'm not going to do it. This Benjaminite is not going to bow to that Agagging Amalekite. Not going to happen. But this creates tension. The other folks at the gate, they start to kind of talk amongst themselves, and then they rat out our man. They're like, oh, he's a Jew. This is why he doesn't bow to you. He doesn't want to follow you, doesn't want to pay attention to you, doesn't dig you. So when Haman, that was a little slow there. That's all right. It's going to come up more. Saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage to him, then Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Yes. So as he made known to him about this people group of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy the Jews. Boo. More than one reason, both for Haman and wanting to destroy the Jews. Right? He's like, throughout the entire kingdom, the whole Persian Empire, we want them all to die. That's a bit over the top, don't you think? It's like, there's this dude got in my face, I didn't like him, he was a Swede, so death to Sweden. You know, it's like, he's just all in. We're going to wipe them out completely. So we have a little bit of a kind of a proto-Nazi here. It's like Hitler would be proud of this whole thing. And so it says that then he cast lots to figure out the right time to go ahead and try to launch his plot to eradicate the Jews. Now, for the month of March, it's Women's History Month, which I think is super cool. But also, it is the same month of Adar, which is, I guess, apparently like anti-Semitic genocide month, which is when the dice land for when he casts lots to figure out what month he's to do this. That's where it falls. And so he's like, sweet, that's when we're going to go kill everybody. And so we're going to go after this entire group of people. So he comes to the king. And he says, king, there's this whole bevy of individuals in your empire. And they refuse to kind of graft into Persian culture, and they refuse to live by Persian law, and he insinuates that they will not pay Persian taxes. And so he's like, oh, there's this group, king, they're not for you, they're against you, they're a big hassle. And so he says, if it pleases the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. They don't like you anyway, let's kill them. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasury. Now, these numbers don't make a whole lot of sense to us, but what he's basically saying is, listen, if you let me go ahead and clean up the kingdom, get rid of these people, I will supply the entire kingdom with 1 year of taxes from my own pocketbook. I will actually pay for the genocide problem, clean up the mess, and you will be none the poorer for it. And so the king basically takes Haman at his word. They sit down, they drink, they party, they have a good time. And in this, the king gives him his signet ring. This is the ring that says you can now make law, and those laws can be binding. Now, what you want to understand about this is why the story of Esther is in the Bible, right? There are only a few times in all of human history, we lived through one, some of us back in the 20th century, where there was a person or a group that literally wanted to wipe out every Jew on the planet. Doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's a big deal. And this story is there because it's kind of reminding the Jewish people that, hey, there's going to come times where you're going to have an enemy so great, they want to dismantle everything that you're about. They want to end the promise to Abraham. They want to cut off the line to the Messiah. They want to refuse the nations to be blessed by God. They're going to come, and you must be strong when they come. You must be wise and tenacious and focused and driven. And this is one of those apex moments. The plot's in place. The guy's got the power. He has the authority. He has the mechanism. He has the financial might. He has the military might to do this. And so this is a big, big deal. So it says letters were sent by couriers to the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews. That seems like over-the-top redundant, but kill, destroy, and annihilate makes the point. Young and old, women and children in one day. So the law saying there's this one day of annihilation. It's like the purge, Old Testament style. And it was on this month of Adar. And in this, you're not going to just kill them. It actually says that you will also plunder their goods. So this is going to motivate the people because you're like, well, why would a bunch of people want to kill a bunch of other people when they have no stake in it? Well, if you go and kill a Jewish family, you get all of the goods of that Jewish family. So suddenly it's like Mercenaryville. Everybody has a reason to want to kill the Jews. Well, when our friend Mordecai hears about it, he's pretty brokenhearted, right? He's like, man, because I didn't bow, I've put the entire nation like under the boot of this guy. I've put the knife to their throat. And so he's just mourning sackcloth and ashes and everything else. Haman, on the other hand, he's thrilled. This is great. Payback, finally. The 500 years of wrong, gonna be made right. So the decree goes out, the king and Haman, they drink it up, and the Jewish population, they're just undone. They're beside themselves. Well, eventually Esther hears about Mordecai. She doesn't know about the decree. This is weird. You're the king's wife, and you don't know about a decree to wipe out a bunch of people? But again, it shows kind of how disconnected things were. So she doesn't know about the decree, but she's heard about Mordecai at the gate, and he's mourning, and he's grieving, and he's sad, and everything else. And so she's like, what is going on? So she sends one of the eunuchs to go and kind of inquire. And then in that space, the eunuch responds back, and he's like, you know what? You got to tell Esther what's going on. So in chapter 4, verse 8, it says, Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued at Susa for their destruction, that he might show to Esther and explain to her that, hey, things are bad. And then in this, it actually says, and he commands her to go to the king to beg for his favor and plead with him on behalf of the people. So he's like, listen, I know you've gone through a lot to get to this place, but now that you're there, yeah, you probably suffered. Yeah, you felt mistreated. Yeah, you've been abused, but now you have room to have power and authority and some sense of privilege there. Use it for the sake of your people. That's what he wants her to do. But Esther sees it differently. Esther goes to the same eunuch that's doing this back and forth stuff and commanded him to go to Mordecai. Yeah. And to say to him, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside of the king's court without being called, there is but one law to be put to death. This is what I'm saying. The king and the queen are not that tight, right? Like she has to worry about if her husband's gonna kill her because she comes in wrong. So she's like, that's the law, dude. Unless the king holds out his golden scepter, right? And then you can live. Then you can come in, you can talk to him. She says, but as for me, I've not been called to come to the king these last 30 days. So she's like, listen, dude, it's a great idea. But remember the last time something like this happened? It's how I got this job, right? The last bride went and did things not according to law or ritual or code, and now she's canceled completely. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for what that was. So I can't risk that in the same way. But then comes one of the most most famous statements in all of Esther. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther. He says, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than any of the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise from the Jews in another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether or not you have come to the kingdom for such a time is this. It's one of the great lines of the story. And I love this because it's the reminder that sometimes doing right things is not going to be easy. To do the right thing is going to be risk. And so he's telling her right now, you can either be on the sideline and be passive, or you can get into the game and you can be engaged. You can wait for somebody else, or you can be the person that God uses to do some stuff. And who knows? Maybe the reason your parents died, maybe the reason you got into this crazy harem sex pageant thing, all of that was for this time to rescue your people. Maybe God was on the move in ways you don't see. So do you really want to sit this one out when God may be using you for great things? It's like, yeah, you've been exiled and you've been, man, rounded up and sex trafficked, orphaned by your parents. But boy, God's given you an opportunity. Then Esther told the reply to Mordecai. Go and gather the Jews found at Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, day or night. And I and my young women will go and do the same. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went and did everything as Esther had commanded. You probably didn't notice that, but earlier in the story, he's commanding her, and now it flips, and she's commanding him. Not normal for women to do, but it's like there's this newfound courage and strength and fortitude in her. And so she resists fear by using the tools of faith, which is fasting. And then she goes to work. But because we know that she's shrewd, she goes to work in a shrewd way. And so we see in chapter 5, she gets all queened up, right? And she goes to just outside the king's court, and I think she just keeps kind of parading back and forth by the door. Like, maybe he'll see me. Maybe he'll see me. She just keeps waiting. She's not going to go in. She's going to wait until he sees, right? So he's like, hey, that's my bride. That's my queen. And he puts the scepter out toward her, and so she comes and touches the scepter, and he's like, hey, girl, what can I do for you? What do you need? And she's like, well, how about this? Can we have lunch tomorrow? He's like, okay, that's what you want. I'm willing to give you half of my kingdom and you want lunch tomorrow? All right. She goes, but can we have lunch with Haman? Nice. He's like, all right, we'll have lunch with Haman. So they get together, they have lunch. After lunch, the king's like, all right, you didn't just put this together for kicks and giggles. Like, what is it that you want? She goes, well, how about this? Can we get together again tomorrow for another lunch? You, me, and Haman. He's like, all right, we can get together. Perfect. Now for Haman, I'm sure he's stoked. He's probably thinking to himself, man, I'm dining with power. This is fantastic. I'm loving this, man. Day after day, I'm hanging with the king, hanging with the queen. I'm amazing. So he's just flying on cloud 9. It says he went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai at the king's gate, and he saw that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai, right? And I love this, right? It's like Mordecai's like, I'm threatened and unafraid. And I'm sure for Haman, he's like, wait a minute. I want to exude a power over him that makes him tremble in his soul, but I don't have power over his inner constitution. What gives, man? I'm top dog. He's not. I'm coming for him and his entire population. Why doesn't he fear me? See, that is a frustration in his soul. Nevertheless, Haman, we were a little mixed there. Boo, yay, no, he's the bad guy, boo. He restrained himself and went home, right? And then he sent for his friends and his wife, and he brought them all together, and he recounted to them all the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions which the king had honored him, and how he advanced so high above all the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, even Queen Esther, let no one in to this party, this lunch, but me, this meal that she prepared. I was just chilling with the king. I was chilling with the queen. And tomorrow I'm invited to go and do it again. But then listen to what he says. Yet all of this is worthless. It's nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. So this dude has power, wealth, family, everything, and he's bitter by one guy. Though there have been times in my own life where I've been bitter by one guy, right? One person wrecks my day. I can't see all the blessings. I just see the curse. And that's where he's at, just doesn't see it. So from this, his wife's like, man, I like what you're saying. I like where you're going. I like what you're serving up. I'm drinking that. So his wife said to him, along with all of his friends, I'm thinking you need to go after this guy that doesn't bow to you. So let gallows be built 50 cubits high, right? And then in the morning, tell the king to have Mordecai hung. Let's kill this guy, right? Then go joyfully to the king and have a feast. This idea pleased Haman. Yeah, and so we had the gallows made fast, apparently. It's like, I got a day, build them, go fast. And so I'm sure he goes off to bed, happy, fulfilled, calm, feeling just so enriched. But the same night, the king can't sleep. And so what do you do if you've got a God complex as a king and you can't sleep? You have people read stories to you about you, right? That's a good narcissist. So he's like, hey, read me some stories. And so they start reading some stories. And then just by chance, they come across a story where there was this dude named Mordecai back in the day that was at the gate. And he foiled a plot to kill the king. So the king's like, wait a minute, that guy, did we do anything for that guy? And they're like, no, dude, you didn't. You wrote it down, but you didn't do anything. He's like, I didn't do anything for him. I didn't give him a prize, nothing. Like, no, you didn't give him anything. He's like, ugh, I got to come up with something. Is there anybody out in my court right now that's here early in the morning doing some work? And they're like, let's go check. They go out in the court like, hey, guess what? Haman's here early. Boo. But he's like, man, I want to pick Haman's brain. So Haman came in. And the king said to him, what should be done to the man who the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, yeah, who would the king delight to honor more than me? I'm the man. I'm having lunch with him. I'm hanging out with his wife. We're going to go vacationing next summer on the Mediterranean, I'm sure. So he's thinking it's him. So Haman said to the king, for the man in whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought and the king has worn. And then let the king's horse be brought to bear in the environment as well, right? And then let that man ride on that horse and be paraded by the king's highest royal official, right? This is going to be great. So he says, let the robes and the horse be handed over to the one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man in whom the king delights to honor, and let him lead that horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. So he's really laying it on thick. I've got to be this guy. So here's what I would love. If it's me, and I know it's me because I can tell it's me, this is what I want to have happen. I'm going to be so celebrated. So the king's like it. Yes, Johnny. So the king said to Haman, boo, hurry, take the robes and the horse as you have said, and do to Mordecai the Jew. Do it to Mordecai who sits at the king's gate. Leave nothing out that you have mentioned. Ah, right? Like, here's this thing, man. He's setting it up. He's teeing up the ball. This is going to be great. And then he finds out his enemy is the dude he has to do this for. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai, and he led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, so shall be done to the man who the king delights to honor. I'm sure there was no enthusiasm whatsoever. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. He goes back to his job. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning with his head covered. So he tells his wife, tells his friends, and basically they go, you're gonna die, bro. Like, you are in bad straits, right? They just acknowledge it's over for you. And so Mordecai's uptrending and Haman is downtrending. And then the king's limo pulls up. It's time for lunch. Might be your last meal. So they get together, they're drinking, they're partying, everything's going. And then the king turns to his queen and says, okay, what is this all about? Like, what are you wanting? What do we need to do? What are you going to be asking me for? I'm willing to give you up to half of my kingdom to do it. What's your wish, Queen Esther? He says, whatever you want will be granted to you. What is it? And so the queen, she answered, well, if I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be granted me for my wish and for my people. That is my request. For we have been sold, and I, my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. And so suddenly the king's like, oh, wait a minute. So my guy, my right-hand guy, was telling me about this people group. He didn't tell me who the people group was. But now I'm finding out my queen is a part of the people group that he's coming after. And so quickly and passionately, the king wants to know what's going on. He says, who is he and where is he, right? Who dare do this? And Esther said, a foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman, right? She points, I'm sure. Boo! But I'm sure for Haman, he's like, spit take, right? Just Pinot spraying everywhere. Because he's like, whoa, I'm in trouble now, right? So then Haman was terrified before the king. And so the king, he rose in wrath from his wine drinking. He's so mad he's leaving his wine, right? And he steps outside to go to the palace garden. But Haman, he stayed to beg for his life, right, from the queen. For he saw the harm that was coming to him. He saw what was coming his way. Well, the king then returns from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking. And just as Haman was falling, you can boo for him right now, just as he's falling into the queen, the king sees this, and he's just torqued. So kind of what's going on is Haman's thinking like, queen, I'm going to bow before you and beg for you. And instead he falls into her, and it looks like he's abusing her or accosting her in some way. And the king's like, oh, dude, you no, don't touch my girl. Don't go doing that. You're dead, man. Not going to happen. And so it's a big, big just gotcha moment right there on the spot. And so as he's trying to beg for his life, it says, at his word, as the words left the king's mouth, Haman's face was covered. So he just basically said, and soldiers just grabbed him, bagged him, took him. Right? And so there's that scene. Well, then one of the eunuchs is like, hey, boss, Haman's a derp, and he did accost your wife, and he's done a lot of dumb things. But yesterday he built some gallows. They're rad. They're really tall. They're just waiting for somebody to be hung from the gallows. The king's like, great idea. Let's hang Haman from the gallows that he built for Mordecai, right? And that's exactly what happens. And so the king's wrath was abated after the execution of Haman. So then it starts to conclude. Haman's dead. And on that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman. Isn't that great? The guy that wanted to take everything from her people, now she's given his stuff because he's the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai, yay, came before the king, for Esther had told how they were related. Like that guy at the gate that you liked that saved you, by the way, we're family. So cool. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman. Yeah. And he gave it to Mordecai. Yes. And then Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So you're like, yay, boo, boo, yay, right? So, but you get the idea. So again, it's such a turn of events. This guy is given a ring to bring doom and death to the Jews, and now the doom and death Jews have the ring that's gonna give them an opportunity for life. Such a great story. But there's still a problem. While the arch enemy is dead, the law is still in place to kill the Jews. It doesn't die with him. And one of the things we don't always realize in the Persian structure is that the Persian king couldn't override laws. He didn't have that authority. There was enough structure that he couldn't just decide, hey, we're going to do something different now. And so it has to be handled in a different kind of way. So Esther then says, if it pleases the king, and if I found favor in your sight, and it seems right before the king, and I'm pleasing in your eyes, she's having to really butter it up. She says, let an order be written to revoke this letter devised by Haman, which he wrote to destroy all the Jews in the province and all the king's people, right? Like, let's just do that. See that no destruction comes to my kindred. And the king's like, I can't do that. My hands are tied. Laws are laws. I can't amend it. But there's this idea, it says, but you can write a counter law to the law, right? So there can be one law for you and one law for those who may be against you, and you can do that. And so from this, an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded, right? And it's basically as simple as this, right? The Jews, no matter where they live, they can defend themselves. When people come to annihilate, eradicate, completely obliterate them from the planet, the Jews can stand their ground, they can fight to defend themselves and their families, and if they beat anybody that attacks them, they can take their stuff as plunder. That's the agreement. Now, you would think in this that most people would be like, well, I'm not going to go fight the Jews. Forget it. I'm done. But you got to remember, they're thinking like, I can get rich if I go and kill these Jewish people. I can take their stuff. That's awesome. So still, on the day that this comes, like 75,000 Persians die at the hands of the Jews. It's still a big bloodbath that day, but the Jews are spared. And in their being spared, they don't even take the spoils of their conquerors. They did this kind of as a good faith gesture to say, this was never about getting rich for us. This was never about wanting to pick a fight with the Persians. This was only about our survival. And so from this comes this feast called Purim. It says, and Mordecai recorded these sayings and sent letters to all the Jews who were in the province of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them and obligating them to keep the 14th day of the month of Adar as the days in which the Jews got relief from their enemies. That's the month where things return from sorrow to gladness, from mourning to holiday. And he says, you got to make sure on this day, man, you send gifts to one another, you send food to one another, and you remember these days of Purim, which means lots were cast to destroy you, and yet by God's grace, he saved you. Such a beautiful story. So what do we get from the story? I think one of the interesting features of this is the fact that throughout the story, you never see God, prayer, law, prophet, miracle. None of that's there. God is the most hidden of any book of the Bible in this book. But he's present and he's active and he's doing things. And so even for us, when we're like, where is God? And why doesn't he show up? And why is this happening? He's there. He might be silent, but he's there. And I look at Esther, who leans into her conditions, and she doesn't talk about how she's a victim and this is not fair to her and how did I get into this mess to begin with? She just does what is right no matter what comes her way. And in this, we see the beauty of, you know, you got to take the journey, but God is always the deliverer inside the journey. Let's go ahead and pray together. Jesus, I thank you for your goodness and grace. I thank you for a story like Esther, right? Unlikely hero in impossible odds, facing just the most harsh and hateful environment. And yet you deliver, you rescue, you save. We thank you for that reminder. We pray that we are those kinds of people in this world, not picking unnecessary fights, being a blessing to our environment, but standing when we need to stand. Help us to be faithful. Help us to favor your heart. Help us to be everything you've called us to be in this place at this time, for such a time as this. It's in your good name we pray. Amen.